Okay, this is the time and place set for oral argument in Miranda Cruz versus State, case number 70960. Are counsel ready to proceed?
Yes,
you filed a reply brief, so you may reserve some time for rebuttal. Please let the clerk know.
I'd like to reserve 5 minutes.
Very well.
May it please the court, my name is Sharon Dickinson, and I represent Salvador Miranda Cruz. I'd also like to introduce to you our trial attorney who's here, Shanna Gullickson. She was the lead trial attorney in this case. I'd like to begin with issue one, which is sufficiency of the evidence. In this issue, I'm not only going to address the facts, I'm going to address the pleadings. In this case, the state pled a felony child abuse under NRS 200.508 subsection 1 based on the fact that the defendant left a child under the age of 18 years in a parked car without adult supervision. That's what that statute's about. Under NRS 200.508(1), it is a crime if a person willfully causes a child less than 18 years old to suffer unjustifiable physical pain or mental suffering as a result of child abuse or neglect, are to be placed in a situation where the child may suffer physical pain or mental suffering as a result of neglect. So what did the state present as evidence? The children were both under the age of 18. One was 8 and one was 2. The state argued they were only proceeding under the theory of neglect. And they argued that the children may have suffered. Not that they did suffer. They admitted that they did not suffer any physical or mental harm. But they may have.
Wasn't there evidence that the children were very upset and all whenever the authorities arrived on the scene and they were in the car and all? Am I understanding the record correctly on that?
Yeah. Well, the record was that the car was parked on a parking lot about 1 a.m. in the morning,
right,
and it was at the Love Store. The children were out there at best. The longest amount of time was 37 minutes. During that period of time, Salvador went out and took care of them for at least 5 minutes. Now, there's a dispute as to
that. But the older daughter was coming and peering in the window, and the younger child, the 2-year-old, had soiled its diaper and so on and so forth. Isn't that what the state of the record is? And it was cold, bad neighborhood.
It was 64 degrees. We have witnesses testifying to different temperatures. Some one said 40, one said 50, but they stipulated it was 64. M.A., the 8-year-old, came to the door one time, and he came out, and he took care of the child who was in the car seat. So he changed the diaper, took care of him, and gave him a soda. But in looking at these facts, is that enough to prove felony child abuse under the statute? I argue it's not. And I think that even the district court questioned whether this was the right statute, because if you look at the jury verdict form, you see that he did give another instruction, and he did allow a lesser for another crime, and that was leaving a child unattended in a car, and the child's under the age of 7. So the district court judge saw this and gave an instruction. The jury did not come back with that. So there was some discrepancies, whether how much evidence do you need to prove for felony child abuse as opposed to leaving a child in a car. And if you look at that...
To what extent, though, the jury was instructed on the lesser? And to what extent was that a question for the jury to determine whether there was sufficient risk to the child to warrant the larger offense, conviction of the larger offense?
Well, under the misdemeanor, the state had to show that there were conditions that presented a significant risk to the health and safety of the child.
Right.
Under the felony, they have to present evidence that the child may have suffered physical pain or mental suffering. Now, they presented no experts. There was no evidence. And in this case, when you're talking about something as serious as physical pain and mental suffering, I think that there needs to be an expert to testify to what these children went through. as opposed to if they did show up, the police showed up, and the children were merely crying or upset. We know that they didn't suffer because CPS released them the very next day. You know, they were not taken to the doctor. They did not see any counselors. There's no evidence of any of that. The very next day, the mother picked him up. That was the end of it. So even without presenting experts, you can look at the record and see that there wasn't this grave of a serious of injury. There wasn't any injury that they presented other than perhaps maybe crying. And I'm not sure that they even testified to that.
Ms. Dickinson, we have a bunch of issues here, and I know we want to get to them. I'm sure that's why it's being argued. This, the use of the transcript of witness Mikayla Bilodge, on her alleged unavailability. I understand she was pregnant. There were some issues with her. Why is it error to use that Justice Court transcript when your office had the right to cross-examine her at the time in the district court proceedings? If you could tell us why.
Well, I believe the issue is whether or not she was unavailable.
Okay.
Because she was subpoenaed through an email. She contacted them 20-something days before the trial and said, you know, I'm 9 months pregnant. Do I need to be there? And the state did nothing. And in fact, a calendar call, the state announced ready. So it wasn't until the overflow calendar call that they said, well, wait a minute, we have a problem with the witness, which they should have known almost a month before, at which time they could have filed a motion and there could have been a decision made as to whether or not the testimony should be admitted. I believe that she was available because the defense said, we agree to a continuance. We would like to cross-examine her. We would like for her to come in. There's a question about the temperatures, and the state is relying on the temperature that evening to argue the children were cold. Now, we know M.A. never testified she was cold, but the state was arguing that that was a factor and to prove child abuse and neglect.
So was she a major witness for either side? That's what I'm trying to figure out from reading this record. It looked to me like she was kind of a fringe witness, but am I misreading it? Was she kind of a critical testimony?
Well, Mikayla is the only witness who testified that Salvador had been in there earlier that evening and then came back.
Right.
She's the only witness to testify to him purchasing lingerie. She testified a little bit differently than the other clerk who was there because the other clerk did not wait on him. She's the one who gave him the change. I think the trial attorney wanted to question her about how much change did you give him to show whether or not he was actually going into the booths to use the change. And she also testified that it was 40 degrees out there, and there was a stipulation that there wasn't. She's the one who called the police. The other clerk didn't. So she was the one who was interviewed by the police. They didn't interview the other clerk at all. So she was the state's main witness as to what occurred. In fact, the other clerk didn't even testify. She didn't even go outside to see where the truck was, and she only knew where it was because it was sitting there for several days.
Okay.
So your point on the motion, you're citing Hernandez and arguing that the motion was late by the
right.
state. Are you also arguing that it was inadequately supported by affidavit showing good cause for the late filing?
Correct.
And you are making that argument under what authority besides Hernandez?
Hernandez, Power, Chavez, and I think probably the most recent case of State versus a Judicial District Court would support that. You do need to have an affidavit or declaration. I also argued about the Massachusetts case where they addressed this issue, Commonwealth versus Housewright, where they had a similar issue in that case, where the prosecutor came in and said, well, our witness is sick. And in Massachusetts, they required something more than the prosecutor just coming in. They required that the prosecutor show some kind of documentation from a doctor. I mean, judges do this all the time with jurors, prospective jurors, who say they have a doctor's appointment. Do you have a note?
And was timeliness objected to in the trial?
Yes.
Was Hernandez raised at the trial court level?
It was.
Reading NRS 174.125, which is the statute that requires that it seems like Hernandez is relying on, it doesn't specifically address a motion for admission of preliminary hearing testimony, oddly. I don't know if you're prepared to address that or if you want to look at it and when you return, address it.
If I'm not mistaken, it addresses motions that are supposed to be filed before trial. Maybe not that specific. I don't have the statute in front of me. I'm sorry, but that's what I thought it addressed. I think it's important for the court to look at the Joseph John H. case. In that case, the state came in and asked for a continuance as a juvenile case and said they were surprised the witness did not show up. And the court later found out that, in fact, they'd been notified several weeks in advance. And in that case, the court reversed the conviction because they did not properly file, follow the rules.
Yeah.
Ms. Dickens, a couple quick questions. I know you want to reserve time here, but procedural issues. On the two issues by the judge, when he started questioning the veneer, asked about three or four questions, I understand, before, he said, oh, whoops, it was swear him in. Did either side object to that or point and say, judge, you got to swear them in first before you start?
No, they did not.
Secondly, on the issue of the admonishment on the first break when the jurors left and the court didn't admonish them to not discuss the case and do the standard admonishment, anybody from either side raise that to the judge?
No, they didn't.
Okay, thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Leah Beverly, Chief Deputy District Attorney, and I am here on behalf of the respondent, the state of Nevada. I was also trial counsel on this particular case. This court should not overturn the conviction of Salvador Miranda Cruz because the court did not make error in this case, and any error that was made was not plain.
How do you deal with Beryl?
Your Honor, it's the state's position.
That this panel isn't going to revisit it, how do you deal with that?
I think this case is different from Beryl in a couple of different ways. Number one, in Beryl, there was an objection when the judge failed to swear in the panel. After the first couple of questions where both sides had emphasized the importance of telling the truth, defense counsel objected, asked to approach the bench in Beryl, and said, we think that we need to swear in the jury, at which point the district court judge said, no, I don't swear in the larger veneer, I only swear in the actual jury. In this particular case, there was no objection to failure to swear in the jury immediately prior to asking any questions.
But I'm assuming the point of the supplemental authorities filed yesterday is to show an unpublished order of this court where we examine the question of this structural error for plain error. So the absence of the objection, the distinction you're making, seems to have been decided differently in the supplemental case, right?
Well, I think it's important to note in this case that the jury actually was sworn in. And I think the timeline, if I can quickly go over the timeline of what happened in this particular case, because I think it makes a distinction from cases in which the jury was never sworn in. In this particular case, and referring to the record, AA Volume 2, page 253, the judge tells them before asking any questions that I'm going to swear you in a moment. At that point, the jury veneer knows that I'm going to be sworn in. It's important that I tell the truth. The next question that was asked on page 253 was, does anyone know any staff? There was no response to that. Then the judge tells them, we plan to swear you in again. This is the second time. He then asked the panel, does anyone know any of the state's witnesses, or has anyone shopped at the Love Store? At that point, two jurors actually did respond, one saying that he knew, it was actually juror 82, answered that he knew possibly one of the CPS workers, and then juror number 60 indicated that he had shopped at the Love Store. The next question on page 256 was, does anyone know the defendant or the defense? And no response was given, at which point on page 256, right after that, the jury was sworn in. I think at that is a distinction between this case and Beryl, that we actually do have our jury being sworn in. So it's the I think that that makes a difference between whether there is going to be structural error when the jury is not sworn in at all versus when the jury actually is sworn in and we're told before any questions were asked that they were going to be sworn in.
Ms. Beverly, one thing I'm concerned about, Ms. Dickinson, one of her arguments she makes is there's cumulative error. And when we get these cases, we look at it, it's like straw on a camel's back, and there's a lot of straw building up on this case with a lot of maybe what you would think are minor things, but the not admonishing the jury, the not, you don't ask questions and then swear them, and that's ridiculous. And this judge has been shot down multiple times on that, and we've reversed a lot of cases. And we can't blame the state, I mean, or the defense. You've got to do what the judge does. But it's very disconcerting to us to see this happen over and over again. And then we have some of these other issues that Ms. Dickinson raised. So why shouldn't we reverse this case on cumulative error by itself based on all these irregularities here?
Sure, Judge. I don't believe that there is cumulative error because the issues, the total of eight issues, it's the state's position that there wasn't error, specifically talking about issue number one regarding the sufficiency of the evidence. In this particular case, the jury was, in fact, given the alternative of leaving a child unattended in a vehicle over the state's objection, and it was the state's objection that that, in fact, was not a lesser included. However, that was given anyway. But the jury, given both options, found that the state had presented sufficient evidence to find Mr. Cruz guilty of felony child abuse. Going on to the second issue, which would be whether there was any error in admitting the preliminary hearing testimony, again, that was also not error. And Ms.
What do you do with Hernandez on that? As I understand the sequence, the calendar call occurred on April 20th, and the state did not file its motion to admit the preliminary hearing testimony until April 22nd. Is that correct?
That is correct, yes.
So you were late?
Yes, and I think the difference...
And there was no affidavit?
That we did file a motion listing the steps that had been taken, and furthermore, before the testimony was actually admitted, the state did have their investigator get on the stand and testify as to why Ms. Below could not testify. I think what is being argued is that she wasn't unavailable because the state knew that she was pregnant. But pregnancy is a fluid concept. The state filed the motion as an anticipatory motion. We did know that she was pregnant. That certainly didn't make her unavailable. What made her unavailable was the fact that she began dilating to 3 centimeters, had to go to the hospital, and was in labor. And so when the state filed the motion on 4/22/2016, that's when we knew that she had begun to dilate, at which point she...
Let me just halt you, though. Hernandez is really specific, and I'm not entirely convinced 174-125 by its terms applies, but it says... Motion subject to the provisions of Section 1 must be made in writing not less than 15 days before the date set for trial, except if it's less than such a motion may be made, blah, blah, blah. Grounds for making such a motion after the time provided must be shown by affidavit. Now, Hernandez, by Justice Hardesty in 2008, picks up that language and says, you know, fairness dictates that the state present by declaration or affidavit the basis for making the motion late. That didn't occur in this case. Hernandez says it reversed and remanded for a new trial based on that omission. And so I'm trying to follow the precedent and understand why that precedent doesn't apply here.
Well, in Hernandez, the court talked about how the standard of review on this particular issue is a question of law and fact. And in Hernandez, in fact, the state didn't present an affidavit. Hernandez ended up saying that, yes, it was error not to have the affidavit, but what was Hernandez was eventually decided on was whether or not the state's offer that the court could have found due diligence on behalf of the state for filing the motion late. In this particular case, even though the state knew that she was pregnant, that didn't mean that she was unavailable. What made her unavailable was the fact that she began to go into labor, at which point the state immediately filed the motion. Not only did we file the motion, we also put up our investigation.
But even then, you didn't put the affidavit in that explained why you were only filing it then. I mean, I understand what you're saying, but I do think there are some bright line rules, and Hernandez looks like a bright line rule case to me.
Understandable, Your Honor, but this, similar to Hernandez, when an affidavit was not accompanied, and in fact, in Hernandez, I don't even believe a motion was filed. I believe that the state just requested that the preliminary hearing transcript be moved on the morning of trial. The court still found that itself was not the error, although an affidavit should accompany. But what Hernandez was eventually decided on was whether or not, even without the affidavit, there was the state had exercised due diligence in procuring the witness. In this case, the state absolutely exercised due diligence and had good cause because we didn't know that she had actually gone into labor until speaking with her closer to the actual day of trial. Even then, the motion was an anticipatory motion because even if she was dilated, she could have possibly still come in. When we actually put up our investigator is when we determined that she had been to the hospital, and at that point, it was just simply unsafe for her to come knowing the state of her pregnancy. So this, the actual motion was an anticipatory motion, and it really wasn't confirmed that she couldn't come until right before it was time for her to testify. But going back to the question of the cumulative error, again, the other issues raised in the brief also show that there was not error. Issue number three regarding the CPS testimony regarding the defendant's statement, there was no error with that CPS worker speaking about the defendant's statements. She had no obligation to give Miranda. She was not operating as an agent of law enforcement. There is zero evidence of that. So that was not error. We talked about the jury selection and going to the specific admonishment that was not given to the veneer during the very first break of the trial. Again, that there has been no indication that there was any prejudice as a result of that. Bollinger v. State, 111 Nevada 1110 from 1995, says that in that particular case, the jury had been admonished after being seated, and there was no evidence of prejudice from failing to do that admonishment. In this case, the jury was told that you shouldn't see, read anything on the news about this, don't talk about anything that you heard in court, and there has been no showing that any member of the actual jury did any independent research or had any bias, so that also was not error. Claim number five involves the oath to the child victim. Again, there was no error in that particular oath that was given. Over and over again, specifically volume two of the appendix, page 419, Judge Smith repeatedly asked the young 8-year-old victim at the time, will you tell the truth? And she emphasized, yes, I will tell the truth. And again, that was overemphasized, and it was clear that she had a duty to tell the truth. Simply because he didn't use the exact language of NRS 50.035, what he did say was an oath appropriate for, she was actually 10 at the time, was appropriate for her age, and it made clear that she had a duty to testify truthfully. And in fact, that was what was given. Claim number six involved various jury instructions. As noted in the respondent's opening brief, those jury instructions were proper. There was no error in giving the credibility instruction that was given. There was no error in failing to give the near certitude instruction. That is in conflict with the reasonable doubt instruction. And there was no error in failing to give the gross misdemeanor alternative to felony child abuse. Gross misdemeanor child abuse is not a lesser included felony child abuse by the plain language of the statute, and there was no error in failing to give the reasonable interpretations instruction. And finally, under claim number seven, which is evidentiary rulings made by the court, there was no error there either. The photos were properly admitted. The state made clear multiple times throughout the record that the one photo that was being shown was in fact how the store looked at the time of the incident. The store had been burned down and subsequent photos were made, but there was no error in that.
The photos, weren't they taken in the daylight where this event happened at night and all, and I think the defense was arguing, you know, the lighting was poor. I forget what their exact arguments were, but does the timing of when the photograph was taken, the daylight versus nighttime, does that mean anything in your view?
Not to the state, Your Honor, because what was important here were the facts that regarding leaving the children unattended, whether it was day or night. It was 1 o'clock in the morning, but it was the facts of leaving these children while he was behind closed doors, where he couldn't supervise them whatsoever, where he couldn't see them. There was testimony about the windows, and in fact, the witnesses cleared up the differences between when this before the store burned down and after the store burned down. But it was important that these children were left alone in this vehicle, an 8-year-old and a 2-year-old, with the door unlocked. It was, whether 64 degrees is cold or not, the jury believed that it was. There were other witnesses' testimony about how they felt, the weather they felt. But what was important is that he left these children alone for a period of time where he couldn't see them for his own habits and his own fault.
Where was the store located again? You know, I know it was, they said it was in kind of a seedy area, but where exactly was it?
It was, I believe it was off of Cheyenne. It was the Love Store. There had been motions about what was
Cheyenne and what? What was the cross street on it?
I don't recall off the top of my head, but there was argument about the type of area that this store was in general. And the state's argument, as we argued on both rebuttal and during closing arguments, is that it's the fact of leaving children alone in a neighborhood where there have been things that have gone on at this store, and there was testimony about that. And because of that, there was no cumulative error.
I'm sorry to take you past your time, but I want to also return to this issue about the motion and the pregnancy. As I understand it, Mr. Miranda Cruz asked that the trial be continued, and there's some law, North Carolina and elsewhere, and some of our cases suggest that the state has a duty before we declare a witness unavailable and the testimony admissible in a criminal case. The state has a duty to make reasonable efforts to bring the witness, and that can extend to stipulating to a brief continuance if the condition that prevents the witness from appearing and testifying live is temporary and will soon be gone. And if the witness is important, it's sort of a discretionary test. Could you comment on that? It is troubling to me that this was sort of came upon the defendant. It's the main witness as to what happened that night that the state relied on, other than the police officers and so on.
Sure. And the state made clear when we filed the motion that whether or not the court granted it, we were still prepared to go forward. And so the defense saying that if the defense just says, well, we'll stipulate to a continuance, that now forces the state in our trial strategy. There were multiple reasons why we wanted to go forward and that we had a right to go forward. So whether the motion was admitted or not, the state was ready to go forward. So,
well, but reasonably, if a woman is having a healthy pregnancy and an easy delivery, that should be quite a temporary disability. Do you believe the state has any obligation to accommodate that as part of its effort to reasonable effort to bring the witness to trial live?
I don't think that the state should have to be forced into a continuance because the defense just simply wants it. When the statute allows the state to use the preliminary hearing transcript of a witness, if the witness has been cross-examined,
I understand that.
Yes, and the defendant was represented by counsel, which he was represented by the same counsel at trial as he was at preliminary hearing, and the witness is actually unavailable pursuant to statute, Nevada statute, which defines unavailability, one of which is being sick, pregnancy being a condition of being sick.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
You have almost 4 minutes left.
You know, there are several problems with oaths and lacks of admonishments in this case. It's not just the jury not being sworn in. It's not just the jury not being admonished on the first break. The court also didn't swear in the child.
Didn't swear in what?
Swear in the child, who was 10 years old, M.A. Okay. He did not give her the oath. And the state did not do an affidavit. They didn't swear to the reasons that they needed the continuance. And then we have the CPS investigator who goes to the jail several hours after he's arrested and gets him to make admissions without any Miranda. So there was no Miranda, no warning, no admonishment. I mean, this whole case is filled with errors like that. And I've addressed
So your point is the jury was not sworn, one of the witnesses was not sworn, the defendant was not Mirandized, the state didn't provide an affidavit to support its motion, ergo, cumulative error, even if not individually reversible error?
Correct, Your Honor. I think it's important that we remember that testimony is sworn declarations, whether it's from a witness or whether it's from a jury or whether it's from a
court. But she makes the point that they called the actual investigator to come and testify about the woman's condition.
That was after they got the motion granted. They had the motion granted first.
Okay.
And she said that, well, we agreed to go forward even without the testimony, so then why didn't they? Why didn't they just go forward? So the motion was granted after much argument, and the defense continued to argue throughout the case. So then they put the investigator on. And I think that that's too little too late. It should have been in the beginning.
Ms. Dickinson, Ms. Beverly offers an interesting distinction in the application of Beryl, and I wanted you to comment on that, if you would. If I understood Ms. Beverly's argument, it was to the effect that the judge advised the veneer of his intention to swear them in, asked a few questions, which identified from at least a couple jurors information relative or relevant to the two questions, and then the judge swore them in. So this is a case of not swearing the jury at all, but one in which the judge swore the jury in late. What's your view about that, and can that distinction be made in light of the Beryl decision?
Well, I don't recall the judge saying on the record that he was going to ask questions and then swear in. I'd have to go back and look.
Well, I'm accepting Ms. Beverly's representation, but she's offered a record cite, and we'll go back and read that. But assuming her description of that record is correct, what's your view of her position? Is should this panel distinguish Beryl in cases in which we have a hypothetical like this?
I went ahead and filed the Moran case, which is unpublished, mm-hmm. because I thought that's what the court had done in Moran. Mm-hmm. And there was no objection, and there was no swearing in.
But at all. I mean, I think Justice Hardesty's point and your colleague's point is these were preliminary questions the jury was told that he was, I'm not saying it's ideal practice, but the jury was told he was going to swear them. And then it was kind of a show of hands on whether anybody knew any of the witnesses or knew any of the parties. And then he proceeded to swear them. So there was an initial preliminary exchange, and then they get into the meat of voir dire. Should that make a difference under Beryl? I'm not wanting to put words in Justice Hardesty's mouth, but I think that's what he's asking. Does it, the fact that it was just a preliminary few questions, make a difference?
Well, those preliminary few questions are very important questions. Do you know witness? Do you know the parties? Do you know the court?
Yeah.
I think the statute is very clear. You have to go ahead and swear in the jury before you ask any questions.
I guess that's the point. If you make that distinction, at what point do you end the distinction? The statute says swear them first. The practice by this judge seems to be persistent. I can't think of the number, count the number of appeals we've had out of his criminal cases where this keeps recurring. It's unbelievable to me. And I accept Ms. Beverly's effort to try to show the distinction, but the statute says, swear them before there's any questions. I'm trying to figure out how in the world one would write an opinion or an order that says, well, after two questions, we're going to say that's okay. And after three questions, well, maybe that's okay. Or maybe the defendant has the obligation to show that there was some prejudice. I mean, the root of Beryl is in the statute. So the statute says, swear them.
Right.
And why a judge wouldn't do that is beyond me.
The statute says swear them. This is the same judge that had Beryl.
Yeah.
And so he knows. He knows this. and now he's doing this. He's doing something different. And the court knows. We raise this every time. And I don't know that I see it with any other judge. It seems to me they seem to swear them in the cases that I have. I don't think you can say, okay, one question's okay or two are okay. I think it's, you know, all. I think that's what Beryl tells us.
It's such a tragic waste of time when it's something that is so apparent. I'm sorry for interrupting. I appreciate your remarks.
Am I out of time? Or can I
you are this? Out of time. If you'd like 30 seconds to wrap up, please do so.
I didn't have a chance to talk about the jury instruction on NRS 200.508 subsection 2 for the gross misdemeanor. I think that is a lesser included. It is within the same statute, and the court erred by not giving that. That would have given the jury three opportunities, you know, to go with a serious felony, a gross misdemeanor, or a misdemeanor. By not providing that, we were prejudiced.
Thank you. This matter will stand submitted, and we will be.